Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Rachel Seifert. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the show.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
Well, Rachel has published four novels, A Boy in Winter, The Dark Room, Afterwards, and The Walk Home, and one collection of short stories, Field Study. Her novels have been shortlisted for the Booker Prize and the Dublin Impact Award, and longlisted three times for the Women's Prize for Fiction, most recently in 2018. Her short story, Fury, is included in Fury's Stories of the Wild, Wicked and Untamed, an anthology of feminist tales by 15 best-selling award-winning writers, which was published by Virago earlier this year. I feel like the title of your story, along with Virago, of course, were probably two of the most desired kind of in the collection. So was it potluck, or did you manage to request it in advance?
I requested it, and I didn't know that the collection was going to be called Furies, actually.
Oh, okay.
I think it was maybe that was a sort of a title that was possible. So I knew that that was, for the whole collection. And so I knew that that was also a possible title for the story. But I already had the story in mind. I knew about this incident. It's based on a historical incident, and I knew about it already. And I just really wanted to write, you know, a character to be the person who instigated this event. And so Fury was just perfect. So when I was approached by Virago, I said, oh, can I have Fury if it's still available? And it was.
Perfect. Well, I was going to ask you a bit about that because I found the sort of historical note at the end of the story very moving. I think particularly because as I was reading it, I kept thinking, gosh, I wonder if this actually happened. I wonder if some kind of, you know, incident like this was based on fact. And then you explain at the end that, yes, it was based on a real life incident in Poland involving a group of Jewish women during the Second World War. I don't want to kind of give everything away if some of our listeners haven't read it yet, but the book has been out for a little bit, so hopefully some of them have. But when did you first come across the details of what happened, and what was it that sort of made you think that this is, you mentioned just now you wanted to kind of write about it from one of the kind of instigating women's point of view. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
This is for a book that I'm working on after the book that I'm currently working on.
I have a
two-book deal with Virago at the moment. I'm just finishing a novel, and then the next book will be a collection of short stories, or a story cycle is what I'm calling it. So the stories are all either the characters cross over or the themes cross over, and it's done in chronological order over across the Third Reich. And I'm particularly interested in German Jewish perspectives, but Jewish perspectives more generally of that time, and particularly in what the material of everyday life under the Nazis, whether you were in Germany or whether you were in one of the occupied territories like Poland, and particularly stories of survival and stories of resistance, and how, you know, I don't just mean survival in its literal sense, as in I didn't get shot or I didn't get gassed, but how you survive the day to day of a regime like that, and of a hate like that lasts for so long. I mean, German Jewish people had to survive for 12 years of it, you know, as well as literally coming out alive, they had to endure those 12 years. And I think also I was very interested in finding stories of resistance because so little is known about that still in the public imagination, although there's been a lot of historical research about it. I think in the popular imagination, Jewish people went like lambs to the slaughter still. I mean, it's right. still something that you hear people say and question and wonder. And so there's a sense of inevitability. If you look at it like that, there's a sense of inevitability about the Holocaust. I mean, it was never inevitable. And then I came across, it was a book published by Virago called In the Light of Days, and it's stories of Jewish resistance, particularly Jewish female resistance, and by Judy Battalion, who's a New York historian. And this incident was one that stuck out. I mean, there are so many in that book. I highly recommend it if you want to feel hope in dark times. Stories of incredible endurance and bravery and intelligence, actually, just fierce intelligence. And then this particular incident, which happened in Poland in 1942, was a group of women who tried standing up to the Nazis when they came, potentially to take them away, but potentially also just to bully.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of that sort of intimidation. It was a huge part of how the Nazis operated and how they demoralized and shook people up so that they would be cowed when they were eventually, when the Nazis eventually came to take them away, they would be cowed and they would be frightened. It took quite a lot to beat people down like that, but that's how they operated. And this was an incident in which a few women stood up. And I was just really interested in exploring how that might happen within a person. So I invented a character called Esther. And many of the things that she does, most of the things that she does actually in the book are all taken from the testimonies of the women that Judy Battalion detailed in her book. So there's lots of historical details that are true. So for example, I talk about people putting acid in light bulbs, for example, to cause fires. And people did that. Amazing. So they caused fires in Nazi administrative buildings by using light bulbs with acid in them as fire bombs. Incredible.
How clever.
Inventive.
Yeah.
And also there's some Polish partisans or people allied to the partisans captured a fighter pilot when he crashed in the reed beds where they were working. And so that also forms part of the story. So all of the little incidents in it, as well as the main one, are taken from those testimonies. And I sort of wove them all together around this character who I invented called Esther.
Sounds fun. I can't wait to read more. Sounds really fascinating. I'm interested because you sort of, throughout your writing career, you've circled this kind of particular period of history. And obviously it draws you back over and over again. And I'm very intrigued by this idea you talk about, you know, you want to uncover the reality of life during these kind of years. You want to uncover these stories of resilience. Are you finding that there's always kind of more to excavate, there's always more stories to tell, there are always more angles that can be looked at of a period of history that I think a lot of us might assume that we already know quite well?
Yes, I mean, there is always more to excavate. It's very interesting because it is a period, as you say, that we feel we know very well.
Yeah.
But I think what we know is we know the camps. That's been... That was almost the first place that historians went to after, not, I don't mean literally, you know, metaphorically, after the war was over. And those were the first testimonies that came out, I guess, with camp survivors. I mean, that's the sort of deep horror, isn't it? That sort of mechanized killing and that whole system. And the idea
I guess it's impossible. It's so horrible. You can't, that's obviously where you start, right?
Exactly.
The very peak of it.
Exactly. And when I was first wrote my first book, The Dark Room, that was what I knew about. But then the historians, so that was, you know, around 2000, 2001, but historians had already moved away from the camps, although people are always still working on it, obviously. But the camps had become less of a focus, and the Holocaust in the Eastern Territories that happened in the villages and the towns and the shtetls and so on, that had become much more of a focus for historians. So when I was writing that book, I uncovered, things in my readings that I hadn't known about the massacres that happened, you know, that were not mechanized killings, but literally bullets in the backs of heads over and over and over again. And this became known as the Holocaust by bullets. So first the historians looked at the camps, then the historians moved to looking at the Holocaust by bullets in the Eastern Territories. And now there is much more sort of talk about Jewish resistance, for example. That's a more recent wave. And also there is a lot more research now on the death marches. So the images, for example, that we know of Belsen liberated, you know, the terrible images of skeletal bodies piled up. Those were actually, a lot of the time, those images were the consequences of the death marches. So the camps were awful, obviously, all the way through they were awful, but they became particularly grisly, and those images of cruelty are actually the consequence of the forced marches that many camp inmates had to endure at the end when the fronts were closing, particularly from the east when the Russians were coming. The Germans emptied camps, and of course there were vast networks of these places. They emptied them and tried to bring the people that they were using as forced labour back into what was old Germany, the old Reich borders. And of course, this resulted in huge losses of life and terrible conditions for people to endure. And so what our popular image of the camps is actually very much informed by these death marches, which we didn't know. Really, no, not those of us laypersons who are not historians. We didn't know this until the last 10 years or so, when this has been really focused on by historians. So it's, you know, our knowledge is constantly, the historians know loads. They look, and then it trickles out. And one of the ways that it trickles out to the general public is via fiction. And so I'm very interested in being one of those people that helps it spread into the popular imagination and to the popular understanding in particular.
And this these sort of stories of resistance and, you know, standing up to it, I imagine they are, I don't know, I imagine as somebody who's kind of, you know, been in this world for a long time and immersed themselves in it and read a lot about it and knows a lot about it, they must be a sort of, like you say, a real kind of element of hope at the end of a terrible sort of dark tunnel. Does it feel like that when you encounter these stories? And I assume it makes them more, you know, you want to write about them, you want to kind of, you know, invent the worlds around them, because they are something that I think all of us want to hang on to, right?
Absolutely. And the people then spring out. I think what you're looking for as a writer, as a writer of fiction, is you're looking for characters always. You're looking for incident. You want your sort of plot line. You want your high point and your arc and all the rest of it. But you're also looking for people. And I think they then spring out to you very clearly. And, you know, they really fire the imagination, because I think of the hopeful element. And I think that's also because of it feels like a rarity in amongst the darkness, and then it's this rare gem that you're looking at glinting there.
Yes, and I suppose as well, in what you were saying about, you know, so much of what we think we know about that period of history and what we maybe do know are or I can only speak for myself in this sense, but is this idea of sort of large masses of people that are not individualized, right? Like, exactly. Because you think of these big groups, and actually what you're saying is fascinating. You're saying that you know, it might be one woman's tiny act of resistance, but in that moment she leaps out at you as this kind of real, completely individual figure that you can then sort of project a kind of fictional life on. But those are the moments that kind of keep you going, whereas actually what a lot of history writing about this period does is not make you see individuals, because it doesn't work like that, right?
Exactly. And also because of our visual images are so informed by by images of the camps, and where you're looking at mass images of masses, and it's, you know, historians have done extraordinary jobs of looking at these photos of masses of people and trying to put names to faces, you know, and that is very, very important work, and that's sort of what I feel I want to contribute to in my fiction, is that you make them people, you don't make them just columns. And also a lot of those images, with a terrible irony, are images produced by Germans. Right. Our images of Auschwitz in particular are very much informed by images taken, film and photographs of the camps and of the Auschwitz camp complex, and at a particular time point as well. I think it was Hungarian Jewish populations were evacuated en masse, or transported en masse to Auschwitz and then gassed right at the end, before they started demolishing the gas chambers, because they were starting to worry about the Russian advance. And so there we have this sort of huge masses of people being brought in and being lined up. And it's a very particular time point in the Auschwitz story, and also a very, very much from the view of the perpetrators.
I think I hadn't even really realised that. I think I'd been thinking about images of the camps after they've been liberated, as it were, but actually, yes, I suppose so much of the that I've seen other photos, obviously, and they were taken before then, right?
Yes. Like that. And they were taken by guards, and they were taken by SS, and they were you know, so they are the perpetrator's view. And also I think when you were talking about the images after the liberation, all those people that we see, they're all of those skeletal bodies are individual humans.
Yeah.
But they become de-individuated by the starvation.
Of course. Well, you know, that's also the point of the camps, right? Is to make them feel like they're not people anymore. They're not persons of any value.
And so, they're and all in actually, the same, in the same terrible garb, and they're all just bone, skin and bone. And so you don't see human anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, they go off and, you know, they have to build their lives afterwards, and you hear stories of that. But actually that sort of point in time is the haunting look on, you know, that some of the faces in those photos is incredibly hard to get out of one's mind, I think. It's very sort of very moving and very sort of thoughtful way to start the episode. Let's shift things a little bit now and move into some of our main questions. I'm going to ask you about a couple of books that are currently on your bedside table, please, Rachel.
Yes, so I've got two, which I'm reading at the moment, and one's fiction, one's non-fiction. And the non-fiction is a memoir by Zhao Lu Go called Once Upon a Time in the East. And she's a fascinating writer. So she's written fiction, but this is a memoir. So she's my age, she's about 50, and she grew up in China, but came to Britain and studied film here, and is also a filmmaker as well as a writer. But this is her the story of her growing up, and it's wonderful. She writes so clearly. It's such a sort of clear and wonderful, a clear-eyed also, not just the prose, but clear-eyed, the way she sees. So she, her early years were in a tiny fishing village, and she was brought up by her grandparents. And her view of her grandmother is very loving, but also just in some ways quite harsh. She looks at her, she calls her a sort of bowed over hunchback, sort of shrimp-like creature, because they live in this fishing village.
Yeah.
And so all of her imagery is about, you know, crabs and shrimps and all and eels and things like that, that, you know, that the men of the village are catching. But she also, and she describes her, she's illiterate, she has bound feet, and she's beaten by the grandfather. And this girl, Zhao Lu, as a girl, sees this and thinks, this is not me. This is not what I want. So she, all she knows is this fishing village, but she's already thinking beyond it. And then she gets her parents come back and are able to take her to live in the town, or the, you know, it's a burgeoning city actually. And they live in a, you know, in a factory compound. Her father is an artist, a state artist. Her mother works in a factory, and they live in a compound. So then you also see China under this sort of very organized communist principle.
Yeah.
That in, you know, that it infiltrates into your private life as well as your working life and so on. But there also you see the position of the girl. So she has an older brother. The older brother has been with the parents the whole time. The girl was the one that was, you know, sent to live with the grandparents. And even when she rejoins the family, she is in the second position to the boy. The boy gets the meat, you know, at the table. Yeah. The girl has to, you know, serve herself last, really. And the girl is hungry all the time. She talks about hunger, hunger. But she's this fantastic. Again, it's this sort of very individuated, very individual, very full of life character. Mm. And full of, there's a sort of an angry undercurrent to her. And that part of her hunger is anger. And it's a wonderful book. It's wonderful. And you, I guess for me, I know a little bit about China. I've read a few history books, but this is really seeing China from the inside and from an individual's perspective, and a very unusual one.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. And also that I love stories about, I mean, you know, real life stories, but that idea that to be raised in such a sort of a very strict environment in different ways, and it sounds like, you know, the two, the fishing village and then the kind of, you know, the government compound, or in the city, the factory life, but to then recognize that your own, you want something more out of that in the future, right? That you're going to, you're still going to break free out of this, and the ability to do that is always astonishing.
It is astonishing. Yeah, it's amazing. And that's what really sort of drives the book, I think, is this perspective. She's in many ways a sort of lonely child, but a child who thinks for herself, you know, and seeks out people to talk to, seeks out new perspectives. And yeah, it's great. And also then I think there's a lot of relatability, actually, for all that it's sort of quite distant from a Western perspective, this idea of having a grandmother with bound feet, for example.
Yeah.
And the idea of living in a communist run compound where, you know, every family has two rooms, but all the doors are basically open and everything is, you know, communal, quite literally. But the position of women feels very relatable somehow.
Really?
Even though it's got this very particular, you know, culturally Chinese aspect, like the bound feet, for example, but the idea that the female is second to everything, just, you know, it's very familiar, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you do, there's a despite the cultural differences or the cultural specificities,
yeah,
it's also very relatable.
Some echoes there, fascinating. And what's the novel that you've been enjoying?
So the novel is a Virago book again. It's called The Red Bird Sings by Aoife Fitzpatrick. And it's also, I was partly drawn to it because it's based on a historical case, and I always really like that. but it's also a real page turner. It's fantastic. So it's based on a case in the US in the 1800s where a testimony, so it was a murder trial, a testimony from a woman is allowed, and not only that, but a testimony which has a sort of séance aspect, or this needs to be edited, but somebody who has a sixth sense about the dead, And so it's a testimony from the dead, actually, not just a woman's testimony, but the testimony of a dead woman is allowed in court for the first time. So it's a murder story. It's also got supernatural elements. And I'm just at the bit. I mean, I know this is all to come, but I'm at the bit in the first sort of third or so where the woman in question is being courted by the man who will murder her. And we know this. This is not a spoiler.
Ah, okay.
You know, we know this from the blurb, so we're anticipating. But we know he's a wrong'un. So I'm at that bit. No. So I'm really gripped by this. Yeah.
Are you often drawn to reading historical fiction? Is it something you like? You like to do?
Yeah, I do. I like the notion that this really happened, in some way or another. You know, I know it's always embellished, and you know, it's inspired by true events rather than these are the true events. But I like that, the weight of it somehow. Mm. It gives it a heft, which
that's
is
a lovely way of thinking about it. Yeah, something it gives it an added layer of complexity or sort of relevance, I think, and then to see what you can do with that, or what an author can do with that, and how they can spin it into something that is then more than the reality is always fascinating to watch, I think.
Exactly. I think, I mean, all fiction speaks, all good fiction anyway, speaks to the world that we live in, and to human experience in some way that is really, you know, doesn't just make you cry or make you laugh, but also makes you think. And stays with you. And it doesn't have to be based on a real event to do that. I don't know, I'm sort of thinking Lucy Barton, for example.
Right, yes.
You know, or any of Elizabeth Strout's, really, it's not necessarily based on historical events, are they? I can't think of anyone that is. But, you know, it's very much about real people. You feel the people are real. But then if it's also based on a historical event, then... you feel the directness of that speaking to real world concerns.
Yeah, beautifully put. Next up then, Rachel, can you tell me about a recent film, a podcast, a TV show that you've been watching? I think you've got a couple of things you'd like to mention, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I listened, I say podcast, let's go serious first. The podcast I listened to most recently was one by Tortoise Media, and by Polly Curtis in particular, journalist Polly Curtis. And it was about the Tavistock Clinic, and particularly the gender clinic at the Tavistock, which I believe has now been shut down. And they're distributing the services across the country. So they were only based in London at the Tavistock Clinic, and now there are a number of clinics being opened for teenagers suffering from gender dysphoria. And now that I've said that, I know that's actually also a contentious word to use, the suffering. But what I mean is kids who are in distress, because their gender identity doesn't accord with their biological assigned gender. And I thought it's a brilliant podcast, because this is such a particularly for women, it's such a hot topic and a dangerous topic to speak about in public, and in a very emotive topic as well. Mm. But this podcast approached it with such care and humanity, and was looking always for the detail. And not the sound bite.
Right.
And not trying also to solve anything or to wrap anything up, but just to look at experience. And it's got six parts, I think. And then there's also, I listened to it on YouTube, and then you can also listen, there's a discussion which you can watch and listen to, where some of the contributors from the programme were invited, and also members of the public were invited to discuss these.
Okay.
And again, that was an amazing way to wrap it up, because again, a very heated topic was dealt with very respectfully, and I felt like this is it felt like a way forward through it, basically. So to give an illustration of how they looked at the nuance. So they didn't, for example, one of the decisions that they made, and they're very transparent also, Tortoise Media, about how they approach things. So they said that one of the decisions they made was that they weren't going to talk about whether gender dysphoria is a thing or whether trans is a thing or not. They were just going to accept it. Yes, it is. For the purposes of this, we're going to say it is a thing. And therefore you didn't have all those discussions about no, it's not real, or it's not you don't go to those far edges where people are screaming.
Yeah, it didn't get bogged down before it got started.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Okay. That what it was looking at were things like whether the care at the Tavistock was gender affirmative, and what does that mean even. So kids presenting, let's say a child assigned male at birth goes to the clinic and says, I believe I am a woman. In the popular imagination, the idea is that the Tavistock then says, yes, you are a woman. Of course you are a woman. And that's it. And there is no discussion of that. And then puberty blockers get prescribed, and the child is placed on this trajectory towards becoming a biological woman with surgery and all the rest of it. And actually, the picture is much more complicated. Hmm. So some clinicians would take an approach like that, let's say, or would, but they wouldn't even be thinking about it like that. They would be thinking about it as a discussion that we are having, and this is ongoing. And it's a way of establishing trust with a young person, but it is not putting the cart before the horse. Mm. The horse before the cart and everything running away. I'm getting my metaphors all wrong.
We know what you mean.
It's a discussion, and it's long term. And then you speak, and then they speak to somebody who had been under the care of the Tavistock, for example. And their perception of how these conversations went was not that it was affirmative, but that it was questioning, and that they found it very confronting, actually. And that they, and I'm calling them they advisedly, because over the course of these discussions, which took years, and which this individual in treatment found hugely frustrating, they said, I had come to a decision. I had already had been on the waiting list for so long before I got there. And then I was confronted with conversations rather than just, yes, here we have treatment for you. That it was actually distressing for them. And it didn't feel affirmative, actually. But then over the course of those years, they came to the conclusion, actually, that they were non-binary. And that's an it's not to say that that's what everybody will happen to everybody, you know, that this this treatment will be these conversations will lead to some kind of change. For some, it won't.
It strikes me that it's very rare to, without getting into the kind of, you know, what side of the argument one is on or not, but it strikes me that it's very rare to find, or I don't often come across stories about this subject that actually really do focus on individuals. Like, exactly. So much of it is the bigger picture of two sides warring about a sort of ideology, right? Rather than actually thinking of the reality of what it means to live in a body that you don't want to live in, or, you know, what the process actually involves. And like you say, it sounds like that process is a very long, ongoing one in which there are a multitude of endings to it. It doesn't, you know, A doesn't always lead to B. And it seems to me, as someone who, you know, knows very little about it, but these are more of the conversations that probably should be having. We should
exactly.
be having.
Exactly that. So that it's always individual people. So you can have a policy in a unit, can't you? but it's always individual people who are going to be working with that policy in a clinical setting with their clients. And so they're going to have those conversations, and those conversations are real and with an individual. They're not just a sort of a line on a bit of paper that says we do this way. And then again, every individual who comes to that clinic in distress and needing help will have their own journey to be going on.
Mm.
And I mean, I think, you know, that they also say in the podcast, they talk about the evidence base or lack of, you know, there are critical voices in the podcast as well, particularly about the assigning, the prescribing of puberty blockers, for example, and the evidence base for how safe that is or not, or, you know, what effect that has at all. You know, we talk about it being safe or not safe, but actually we just don't know yet anything about it, really. Mm. Not enough. But without them being prescribed to some people in the clear knowledge that we don't have yet an evidence base, until we build that evidence base, people will need to take them and see what happens. But as long as that's transparent, maybe that's the only way forward.
Mm.
And also, very few people get prescribed these drugs.
Mm.
If you, you know, it's always in, it's, you would, if you listened to many of the voices on Twitter, X, or,
you assume they're being given out like candy.
Absolutely,
right? But the reality is that it's not easy to access.
It's very difficult to access,
yeah.
And partly because the evidence base is so small. So they should be very difficult to access, actually. Mm. But it's not as if they're being given out willy nilly, and without being mindful of these things, of the issues around them. It's just that, you know, it's all the shades of grey in this podcast, basically. And it's all, you're listening to individual humans. And there is also space given for, I mean, Hadley Freeman is a contributor to it, for example. And her take, you know, it comes from her experience of having anorexia so seriously that she spent two of her teenage years in the hospital, actually, largely. And she knows what it's like to live in a body that you don't want to be in, basically, or the body that distresses you. Not from a gender perspective, but, you know, she has the insight. That's her insight. And also she saw that for children suffering from anorexia, there is a sort of a contagion aspect, and that children spur each other on in these settings, in these hospital settings. Children talk to each other about weight loss techniques, keeping your weight down, and it perpetuates itself. So that's her worry, that there is a contagion aspect, you know, that it's not, that not every child who presents with gender dysphoria is actually trans, let's say. And it was important that somebody like that is given voice. You know, somebody like Hadley Freeman is given voice and is given, you know, this is, again, a nuanced perspective, and one that comes from an individual experience and comes from an angle that looks at teenage experience more generally, mm. and teenage distress. And it wasn't at all what you might imagine that conversation would go like. And
fascinating.
You know, so I think it's a really valuable podcast. It's particularly valuable for anybody who has teens, anybody who works with teenagers, but just anybody who's even vaguely interested, or who has who just wants a bit of light and less heat.
And you were also going to mention a couple of slightly lighter topics, but I think linked in with teens and some shows you've been watching with your own children recently, right?
Yes. So I'm going to sing the praises of rewatching. And
big fan of that here.
So I, with my husband, we rewatched the whole of The Wire earlier on this year, which was such an amazing series, such an amazing bit of writing, actually. Mm. And the characters, each character, so well drawn.
And was it as good as you remembered from first time round?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Okay. It really was. And then also watching it again means that you're looking a bit more at characterization and structure and so on and so forth. And so it was very interesting from a writing perspective. Just the shades of grey there again. So nobody is wholly good. Nobody is wholly bad. And there aren't really two sides. We're talking about the police and drug dealers, but there aren't really two sides. Everybody blurs into, you know, this city full of humans, Baltimore full of humans. The other thing that we've been rewatching is Frasier. And we've been rewatching that with our kids. So our kids are 20 and 17, both still living at home and studying. And we watch an episode or two of Frasier with our dinner each evening.
And do they like it?
They love it. They absolutely love it. I mean, some of it is, it's odd because time has moved on. And so, for example, there was an episode recently where Frasier chats up or gets chatted up by a young shop assistant. So he's early 40s, we're given to understand, and this shop assistant was 23 or 22. And and my kids were sort of... but they were horrified. I mean, the idea of that's really changed. It made me realize how much times have changed, and that predatory older people or older people dating younger people has a predatory tinge to it.
Yeah, it just has that now.
It really has. It made me also realize that my attitudes have changed. I did think, the performances are so amazing in Frasier. Niles is particularly, the brother in Frasier is particularly good. And there's physical comedy, there's great wit. And it's just this, these little, it's 20 minutes or 25 minutes because we watch them without the advert break. And so it's really short and sweet and wonderfully constructed and just so funny. My kids really love
that. It's the perfect length, isn't it, for a lovely, you know, a couple of episodes in the evening and just the kind of, and you're making me want to go back and watch it, thinking of, you know, years ago and remember when it used to be on the telly on whatever night it was. It was kind of, was it like a Friday night telly? The Friends, Frasier, like that kind of thing, and everyone watched it. And some of those, I feel like I've watched some Friends more recently that hasn't maybe quite kind of lasted in the same way, but you're making me think I should go back to Frasier and give it another go.
I think the characters are just great. You know, I think maybe Friends is, you know, might sort of work for a time in your particular time in your life when you're maybe that age as well. I don't know. I never really watched Friends, so I don't know. But this is what I imagine.
Right.
Whereas Frasier has got lots of different ages in it and is much more sort of based around, it's much more silly, actually. Than I'm.
Yes, I think I've forgotten maybe how much sort of physical comedy there is in it and actually the kind of, and the sort of play back and forth between the various family members, the different generations. You're right, it's got something for everyone there, really. Arshel's be back in just a moment.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I'm talking to Rachel Seifert about the glories of Frasier, how everyone should go back and rewatch this 90s classic, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is it 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah, it probably is, isn't it? Next up then, Rachel, can you tell me about a book that made you think about feminism in a new way?
Yeah, so I actually want to say, I go back to the book that I was talking about earlier a little bit and just reinforce that, Zhao Lu Go, and the experience of Chinese women and the experience of Western women. Maybe we're not so different. The one that I, when I was sent these questions in advance, the one that I, that sprang to mind was Audre Lorde and The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House. Mm. So very sort of slim. It's an essay, really. But I guess I read it published in its own right in this little sort of pamphlet-like book. And just this idea that you're living in a structure, whether you know it or not, and that you can't, there are limits to what you can do from within that structure. There are limits to change unless the structures of society change. And that was, for me, a real, Audre Lorde was a real eye-opener at university.
Is that when you read it the first time?
Yeah,
when you were at university?
Yeah. And I also read her poetry, and I think she's fantastic. I still teach some of her poems. So I work with young people. I work with an organisation called First Story, who place writers in secondary schools. So I'm writer in residence in London secondary schools, and I use some of Audre Lorde's poetry. She writes the teenage experience extremely well. Oh. I mean, she's this fantastic theoretical feminist, but she's also an incredible poet who puts human experience on the page.
And do the students you teach, do they like her work as well? Is it something that resonates with them?
Yeah, there's one which talks about, you know, a child listening to arguments behind a closed door, and but knowing, the child is more knowing than the adults would expect. And the kids I teach really relate to that. And also, I think it's the that she writes a black teenage experience. And many of the kids that I teach are black because I teach in London. And then she writes, there's a detail which the kids that I teach have picked up on again and again, which she talks about having ashy knees. Mm. So and then they know that the speaker is black, or that the voice in the poem is a black voice. And I think there is that, then there's that connection. And it maybe is still unexpected to them that there would be a black voice on the page.
And I think you mentioned when I was learning about your answers prior to the show, sometimes I get told them early, everyone. You said that East German feminists particularly had a big thing for Lorde. They really, Lorde's work particularly resonated with them. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes, I mean, there was a documentary which made about this, and I still haven't been really able to track it down. It was coming, so I live in South London, it was coming to Peckham Plex just at the time when the pandemic hit. Oh, and no. So it got cancelled.
Oh, and then one of those ones that sort of fell through the cracks.
Absolutely, then, yeah. Oh, so I think yeah. The documentary maker maybe had a connection to the cinema in some way or another. Anyway, anybody out there, if you know about this documentary about Audre Lorde going to East Germany, please get in touch with Veronica and let me know how I can see it. It really should be seen. I only know a very little bit about this, but I find this fascinating. So Audre Lorde was one of those people who ended up having to go from America to find an audience, actually.
Yeah.
Find a properly receptive audience. So Renée Edo-Lodge published the book, you know, maybe 10 years ago now, Why I No Longer Talk to White People About Race. And Audre Lorde made a similar kind of statement, but particularly to white feminists in the 70s in America. And she wrote an open letter to a particular white feminist, I think, which was basically pointing out that white women dominate and they don't listen to black voices, and that this is exclusionary, and you know that white feminism needs to look at itself, or American feminism needs to look at itself and needs to be more inclusive, and. She went to East Germany. So East Germany was then still East Germany.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if she was invited or how this came about. But there, because she was talking about structural change, because she was talking about wider change, she found listeners. And there are amazing pictures. There are amazing pictures of Audre Lorde sitting, this black woman, sitting on a chair, and white women sitting cross-legged, enwrapped, listening to
her. Looking up at her.
And you just think this woman had to leave her home in order to find an audience, in order to find people who would really listen to what she had to say. And funnily, I think Angela Davis also had that experience. Angela Davis came to Europe and found a left-wing audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Nina Simone, also a very political figure, but maybe less obviously so, I guess, because she's a musician. But she also came away from America, didn't she? She followed James Baldwin. I mean, there are so many.
I was just thinking, because I feel like I can think of quite a few Black American writers and artists and musicians who've moved to France maybe at some point during the 20th century and found a sort of creative freedom there. And, you know, Baldwin, obviously, Simone, all those. But I think I know less about people going to Germany. But then just as you start mentioning this, I'm sure I have seen pictures of like Angela Davis there, maybe Audre Lorde, these women who, and the idea that as a kind of society, these women, because of the society in which they were living, they were much more open to this, and they could kind of see the resonance of it in the way that American society couldn't, is endlessly interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, American society was still very, you know, that was the Cold War, wasn't it?
Well, yes, there's that as well. I mean, it's got all the kind of problems of the sort of hangover of segregation, and then you've also got the issues of the Cold War on top of it. So, yeah.
Exactly. So, so it's a mix. It's a terrible sort of, for those people who were wanting people to listen, was a terrible mix of those histories, anti-communist and the racist history of America sort of overlapping.
And that's interesting as well, because we've had so many people recommend Audre Lorde on this season, particularly of our show as well. Yes, interesting. I think I was just saying in the sort of last episode we recorded, there must be something in the air, because so many people have picked her for this exact question, I think, or the next one's coming up. And I think that, but we haven't talked about this particular angle of her work. So this is new, at least, which is great. And it's just lovely as well. It's really nice that, you know, that people are, you know, finding her work important in a way.
Oh, absolutely. Still, yeah.
You know, yeah, there is. Yeah. And I think we're going to talk about her again. Now, the question, tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you admire. I think you might want to talk about her some more, or just reiterate how wonderful she is.
I think what's wonderful is introducing her. I sort of talk about introducing Frasier to my kids. Mm. Now I think about introducing Audre Lorde to kids here in London. That's also wonderful.
Yeah.
That's one of the lovely things about being older, actually, is that that you have accrued things. You've accrued ideas, knowledge, different perspectives, and then you can share them with younger people. And I think that for some of the girls, I was writer in residence in a girls' school in Tulse Hill in South London for 3 years, and some of them found the Audre Lorde a bit confronting because Audre Lorde was a lesbian, and so they would, they'd go and find out more about her. I would introduce a poem, then they would go and find out more about her, and then they would come back and they'd say, "Oh, miss, she's a lesbian." But then there would be all those sorts of discussions that would go on in the classroom with other people saying, "No, that's cool. What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that." And it's amazing to see how these same discussions happen but have a different flavour. So I can remember that in my teenage years, the idea of being a lesbian was also ugh. And it took discussion for it to become not ugh. And this is still happening now. But the voices that say it's fine and it's good are louder. And it's not, that's what's changed, I think, over the years.
I love that idea about sort of the louder, a voice that is, I mean, obviously Lorde's was a loud voice to begin with in that it was always important and being listened to. And sort of, but maybe over time, yes, it's been sort of magnified in different ways, and that we're more, a lot of us at least, are maybe more receptive to listening to what she's got to say now, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think also it's not necessarily then, there's more allyship as well. So I see that happening. It's not only girls who think they might be lesbian who are speaking up for lesbians, but it's also girls who are very secure in their heterosexual identity who say, "Yeah, what's wrong with it?"
Well, finally today, can you tell me about your golden apple? This is the virago book that you would regularly recommend to others. Maybe one or two examples here. I think you had a couple you wanted to mention, right?
I do have a couple. So I'm half German and half Australian. And my dad was Australian. And he was the first person actually to give me a virago book. So this was the 1980s. And he was very excited because virago, the lovely old classics in their green covers.
Everyone's favourite.
Everyone's favourite.
Yeah.
That there were Australian authors among them was very special to him. So he was an Australian expat. He had come to Europe, decades before. But he still, my dad actually suffered from the colonial prejudice, let's say, so that he was from the colonies. My dad was a white guy, and he worked at universities and so on. But he was of blue collar heritage. White collar working class, let's say, and he was Australian. So when he came to the UK, he was very much viewed as this, viewed with disdain. Actually, he really felt that. He worked at Oxford University, and he had students who would deliberately leave one chair too few in the room when he came for a seminar, so that he would have to say, "Can somebody go and get a chair?" And then they would laugh amongst themselves.
Wow.
The layers are sort of weird class and
and just the other mucky levels of colonialism, right?
I think so. It was very important for him that Australian literature was taken seriously, and he really loved that virago picked up people like Miles Franklin. So, and I loved My Brilliant Career. So I read it when I was, so the protagonist is about 16, and I read it when I was about 16, and I absolutely loved that voice. There's a rebellious girl who looks at her her surroundings and finds them terribly parochial and can't wait to go to the big city. And has this very sardonic eye on her family and on her community. So I would, that's my, one of my golden apples is My Brilliant Career by Miles Franklin. And then the other one is a more recent one. So virago continues to find wonderful golden apples. Mm. And this one is to honour my German side, and it's The Seventh Cross by Anna Zegers. And it's a brilliant book written in 1938. So, at the really in the midst of Nazi oppression. And Zegers was a communist, and Jewish. So she had double reason to be fearful of the Nazis. And she writes about a prison breakout. So the Nazis established camps in Germany first, places like Sachsenhausen and Dachau. And they were for dissenting voices of all kinds in Germany. And Seegers writes about a prison breakout. So seven prisoners break out from a camp near Mainz, which is where she lived. And it's the sort of the story of one of them in particular, but one by one they're caught. And those are the seven crosses. And you follow one in particular, going from place to place, trying to find safety in this very unsafe world of Germany in 1938. And it's a brilliant book.
Were you aware of it before Virago did their recent reprint?
Yeah, so I read it in German, in my 20s, I think I must have been.
Yeah, I feel like it was quite famous in Germany, right? I mean, as in, I don't know enough, but she is quite famous. But I feel like it's quite recently that because Virago published her over here, and I think she was published in America recently as well in translation. And so it's been kind of new to English language speakers, but in Germany, she's quite well known already, right?
Absolutely. In Germany, she's very well known. And Gunter Grass, for example, cited her as one of the most important 20th century voices. You know, so she has she has pedigree in Germany. But she was also, interestingly, it was published in her, you know, at the time it was published.
Yeah.
And published in America, too. So it was picked up. She had to flee. And the manuscript, so one of the copies of the manuscript fell into the SS's hands. But then she managed to get one copy smuggled out. She went to Mexico and one copy was smuggled out and landed with the publisher in America. So it was published and a film was made of it also during the Second World War with Spencer Tracy in the title role as one of the prison
breakers. Yes, of course. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah.
So she had that sort of early recognition or recognition during her lifetime. But then she was post-war. She was recognised again in Germany. I mean, she's a big... She's part of the canon, post-war canon in Germany. But yes, having that book in particular published in new English translation and by Virago was really special to me, because it's such an important book for me, for Germany, and then to have it available to British readers now, and you know, with the apple on the spine.
Exactly, the mark of a brilliant book, right? That apple, the green apple that everyone wants. Exactly. Well, that's a perfect place to end it, I think. Two brilliant recommendations there, My Brilliant Career and The Seventh Cross. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rachel. I very much enjoyed chatting.
And thank you. It's been a lovely morning.
Thank you everyone else for listening. Our Shells is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Rachel Seifert, and tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.